Okay, so today we are here with Professor Helen Cafferty, and I, Skylar Wally, are in Adams Room 403 in Brunswick, Maine, Bowdoin College, on October 21st, 2011. And we are looking to discuss some of Professor Cafferty's experiences at Bowdoin as one of its first female faculty members. So I was hoping we could just start off with sort of how you found Bowdoin, how you came to this college when you did.
Well, I was finishing my degree at the University of Michigan, and at that period, which was early 1970s, it was quite common that one could get a job while you were finishing your dissertation, finish the dissertation, the time clock went very differently. So I was looking for any job that became available, and there were several in the East, and my family lived in the East, and at least Western Pennsylvania, which is sort of east mm-hmm. of Michigan, at least. Mm-hmm. And I was attracted to a private college experience. I knew that I wanted to teach in a liberal arts college. Mm-hmm. I knew I didn't necessarily want to pursue a graduate research professorship career. And so when this job came up, I did some research at on Bowdoin and on Maine, mm-hmm. and I was completely smitten by the idea of coming to Maine. And in the 70s, it was a sort of wide open, beautiful place. It really was a very different place than it is now, although now it is equally as nice. And so I was very attracted to it. And having had public education most of my, from high school on, I was quite curious to experience the different side. Mm. So when it came to Bowdoin, I had a long series of hour interviews with everyone on the faculty wow. committee. And they were very cavalier and gracious and perhaps just a touch patronizing, but with the best motivation, I think. And I was interested in the department. Professor Cerf and Professor Hodge, mm-hmm. who is now retired, were the other two people in the department. And so we had interesting discussions. We argued about literature and about film. Mm. And I was very excited to come here. And I felt very lucky to come here. And so I arrived. Well, I could say, I mean, these are just some of my random memories. Mm-hmm. When I went for these long, intense interviews with the mostly senior faculty, Professor Poles, Professor Moulton, mm-hmm. I think Dana Mayo, mm-hmm. And Professor Donovan, mm-hmm. the government department, the illustrious group. I remember walking across campus and it beginning to snow, and thinking how beautiful the campus mm. was. And it was quite different from now. There are many more buildings on campus, and yet the chapel was there, the quad was there, Massachusetts Hall, a version of Adams was there, and Sills. And of course, that was the side of campus. I was on Hubbard, of course. And the new library and we called it the senior center of where Thorne Hall mm-hmm. and That was very new. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was the tallest building in Maine. And people were actually coming to see it. So it was quite an experience. And I thought, well, this is a beautiful place mm-hmm. and a challenge. Mm-hmm. I had very little experience. I only had experience with co-education. So I found it a bit daunting, but I didn't quite understand what it really implied, coming to a college that was just beginning to make those changes in co-education. You know, I learned later that it was very difficult and not the easiest decision for the boards, and maybe the opinion of some of us at the time was that this was part of the move, a general movement in education away from single-sex education, that it was a move not taken in the interest of educating women, but in keeping up with currents in education at the time. So that meant that we got together at the when I came in 1972, I believe there were two wives of faculty members who taught part-time. In, as I remember, I can only remember one math. Mm-hmm. Betsy Groby was teaching in math as an adjunct. And there were, maybe there was another. And there was a visiting Tallman professor in history who was very nice and really very gracious. But of course, she wasn't really part of the institution at that point. I came with Wendy Bhattacharya, who was an assistant, appointed as an assistant professor in the sociology and anthropology department, and with Melinda Small, mm-hmm. who was being appointed, I think, already with as an assistant professor with the promotion implied. And so that was the three of us. And there was also a visiting assistant professor in philosophy, I believe. And that was it.
Wow.
So because I think because the college, there were many different motives for the decision to educate women. And perhaps that was not the foremost reason, but you know, suddenly they had to think about this, what it meant, and we were put on a committee. But rather than talking about fairness to women, behaviors in the classroom, making women feel comfortable on campus in terms of aspirations for women, we were asked to think about what kind of hair dryer should be in the locker rooms and things like that. And we complained a lot about that. And they were interested in what we had to say, but I think we were just so, you know, we helped them with some of this practical advice, but they weren't so interested in the other. And of course, we were all wanting to succeed at Bowdoin. And I had come from a huge University of Michigan. So one of the things that was most daunting, I would say, about being at Bowdoin was the visibility and the fishbowl quality. Suddenly, I was a young instructor, and so I had some of the professors assume that I was a student. Many times, because I was below, I was in my late 20s, and I looked pretty young, and it was not, you know, it wasn't mean-spirited, and I found very little mean, in fact, I would say I really never found mean-spirited professors or wives of professors or staff. Bowdoin was an extremely gracious place then, as it is now. And people were trying to welcome us as best they could. So the male faculty was very, you know, at worst awkward. And were either somewhat condescending without meaning to, or cavalier. I mean, nobody actually threw their coat down over a mud puddle for me to step across, but there was this attempt to be polite and respectful in that way. So there were many anecdotes told around about people's perhaps awkwardness. I did find though that in those days, because there were so few women faculty who made careers, the wives of the male faculty were very involved in welcoming new faculty, which was overwhelmingly a male contingent, but there were now women members. And so we would be invited into the homes of not just one's department or, you know, some official kind of welcoming which is really part of trying to orient new faculty members to the college now. And that was very valuable. One, I felt very welcomed and very supported by a group of faculty families who were particularly supportive. Roy Greeson and Polly in their early, I think, at a period when he was, after he was dean and before he became president, I remember his kind and supportive mentoring in lots of casual ways that only in retrospect have I really understood. You know, it was a very light touch with which he helped me understand the college and the responsibilities in very casual ways. So what might interest your listeners was the institution of the faculty tea. The wives would invite other wives. These are faculty wives tea. So, of course, I was going to faculty meetings and I was trying to learn about what it meant to be a faculty member at Bowdoin under these strange circumstances. And, but I was also invited to the faculty wives teas. And I did go. And it was charming, and I was very fond of the women, and they were very supportive of me. And you know, I'd get out my, I had, I think, one pair of gloves that was left over from somewhere that I would put on. And it was a way of being with women, which sort of comforted me, mm-hmm. I think. Being away from my own family and my own network of aunts and other women, the friends of my mother and my mother's age, mm-hmm. and so forth. So this was very nice. Mm-hmm. And I think the real issues that created some dissatisfaction was the difference in standards for women's admission and men's admission. Mm. We were very unhappy about that. Mm-hmm. And we thought the women were great, and we had many excellent men students, but we knew that higher standards were being applied for women's admission. Mm-hmm. And this just begins to, you know, it just doesn't feel right. Mm-hmm. It's just seemed a bad way of going about it. Mm-hmm. And so through the years, and I think it was really the admissions office itself who came to the conclusion that one could not sustain this kind of inequality, mm-hmm. as far as admissions, mm-hmm. was concerned. And so when they went to equal percentages of applicant pools, I think is the way they did it, that part of it felt like a relief. Mm. Because although there were voices, and we were always, whenever we had a chance, we were looking to make this point, there were really very few, mm-hmm. voices making this point. So we were sort of peepsing out there in a vacuum, and really didn't, I think, have that much impact on the movement of the institution. Mm-hmm. But certainly, we were very, very active in curriculum development, mm-hmm. which was something that was immediately apparent that the sort of incipient, I mean, it was really just beginning women's studies as a field, and so there was no mainstreaming of women's studies whatsoever. And this was 1972 when I came, so 1 year after the first group came. And it was clear that this was really something that needed to be done, mm-hmm. to have the college at least responsive to academic impulses that were occurring elsewhere. And so we began to talk more about the possibilities of women's studies courses or women's focused courses. This would have been in the 70s. Mm. And so there were some team taught courses that I participated in the Senior Center. Mm-hmm. At that time it was called the Living and Learning Center, mm-hmm. and seniors and some faculty lived in it, mm. and it was considered a special senior experience. Mm-hmm. And that was all the rage. That, I mean, there were, Bowdoin was not the only one to do this. And I think there's still a lot of discussion. What makes the senior year different and special from, mm-hmm. everything else besides people, you know, under the gun trying to find jobs? And so we did teach a course on literature with focus on women.
Oh, wow.
In the 70s at the Living and Learning Center, the Senior Center. And we met in those rooms up at the top. And that was very exciting. And soon thereafter, I taught a course in the German department in English called The History of German Literature with a focus on women. And I think that was probably the first departmental course early on. And these were just very isolated attempts to at least have a presence. And probably the beginnings of, you know, women at Bowdoin, not just as people, but also as an academic pursuit.
And you've touched upon this a little bit, and I was just wondering if you have sort of any anecdotes or if you would be interested in describing sort of your personal interactions with students, whether they be male or female, and sort of how that felt as a new young female professor at a sort of transitioning into co-education school.
Well, you know, I was teaching German, so there were, of course, more men in most of the classes at the beginning, although not exclusively so. We had quite a few women who took classes all the way through and were German majors. As far as anecdotes are concerned, that's really, well, I have a few, but I don't think I want to talk about them. I'm trying to think of some. There were students who, I think, you know, we were also in the forefront of student-centered discussion, and because we were beginning to be very aware of positionality and we were trying to open spaces in the classroom in different ways. And I remember, and of course this does go along with language pedagogy anyway, because you're, you know, it's very student-centered, people are practicing and talking to each other. And one time, I think this was in a third year, a German language class. I did something differently. I basically lectured in German and wrote on the board a lot. And this is something that happens in the more advanced classes to prepare students both conceptually but also linguistically for what they're going to meet in their homework and the reading that they're going to do. And so I talked about existentialism in German literature, in German, and tried to set up. And one of the students came up after and said, "Finally, you're getting the hang of what it means to be a teacher at Bowdoin."
Oh my God.
"You're finally getting the hang of it." And I said, "Okay, thank you." But it was clear that, for, you know, this was a student. And it wasn't certainly all male students who thought that, but this was a very conservative student. And so he definitely wanted the lecture format and felt very comforted by it, and probably also was relieved to know that I actually did know something. And so I guess that would be one story. And the other thing I ran into, again, from other faculty, not so much with students. Students were, you know, it was mixed classes, even though men outnumbered women, but women were very vocal in language classes and were, I did not feel until much later, when the critical mass had changed, that women became quieter. Actually, I think the early years women were, the women who were accepted here were very confident in their own abilities and knowing mm-hmm. that they were going to meet challenges and were determined to do so. Mm-hmm. And so you didn't really have this feeling you had to get, you know, help them speak. Most of them really knew how to speak mm-hmm. and spoke out. Mm-hmm. But I guess for me it was more this awkward environment where you would have something like the anecdote happen one day and another day someone would refer to you as a girl instructor, but not meaning it bad, you know, it was just, but of course in those days linguistics had not been opened up yet. So, you know, now we're more relaxed about whether a lot of the equality that feminists demanded in linguistic expression has actually been mainstreamed. And so whatever happens on the edges, everyone is reasonably relaxed mm-hmm. about. But at that time, this hadn't happened yet. So it really felt difficult. And you knew that the person was well-meaning, and where they were coming from, you really could not make a terrific issue out of something like that. Mm-hmm. So there was, it was a feeling of being kept off balance a bit, and of also being very visible. Mm. So that every mistake you made or it felt very magnified. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we read about sort of in reviewing co-education that was occurring in multiple institutions was for women entering college, there was oftentimes a message given to faculty, staff, administration of sort of this in loco parentis, that you have to be their parents since they're now going into college, they're taking a step outside of the home. And I'm wondering if you experienced feeling that sort of responsibility or if that message was communicated to you at all, or on the contrary, if you felt as if that wasn't the case.
I didn't feel, and this may just be memory, I never felt that they were telling us we needed to do this. You know, it was an era of coming out of the 60s. Mm-hmm. So there was substance abuse and there was all kinds of stuff going on in the student body. Not, of course, not everybody. It meant that, you know, in terms of date rape and some of the things that we talk about very openly and try to get a handle on now and have structures, and this was not the case then. If there was sexual harassment, I mean, those kinds of things were handled. I mean, we were involved in talking to students sometimes about some of these things, and it was very difficult mm. to figure out what to do about it until we were able, really quite late though, have mechanisms, and it's still not that easy, but at least it's discussed. And so I do remember these things. I came in an era, for example, when there were no students didn't evaluate professors. Mm. And so at the beginning, there were, I would say it was just beginning. And so there were students who were running the operation of evaluating professors, and I think they did a pretty good job. And so there was a feeling that, you know, students lived in fraternities early on. They did a lot of what I would say was community work, mm-hmm. and community service. And I think there was a general feeling that students were expected to be adults, mm. and some people called their students by with Mr. and Miss. That's very difficult to do in language, although I experienced it in mm-hmm. my own. But so I was coming from one educational era, mm-hmm. which expected students suddenly to be those adults that might be addressed as Mr. or Miss at the time. And so I do remember a transition from a feeling that students were able to, for example, run the fraternities mm-hmm. as service organizations and do a good job of it and really run their own business and do a good job of it, to a period where things started to fall apart. Mm. And I do remember, in locus parentis, I remember us discussing that mm-hmm. amongst the faculty as being good or bad, and it felt as though there were changes happening mm-hmm. that created new needs, but it wasn't necessarily, I suppose the debate was about whether we were the ones, the faculty, who should be in those positions. Mm. Because, and of course, women who are socialized to be sort of maternal and nurturing, I think that created somewhat of a bind. Mm. I know that there was research that we discussed at the time about, as these evaluations got going, mm-hmm. about, you know, women who were authoritative and who did the things and acted like those people who achieved success were judged differently. Mm. From men who acted that way, it was considered maybe a little negative. It felt difficult at times to be taken seriously mm. if you were young. As one gets older, it's easier. Certainly, I found it so. But those were some of the issues that we really did talk about. Mm-hmm. What it felt like to be judged on the one hand professionally according to a male standard, but in terms of student expectations, mm. a somewhat different one that really came from where? The family. And this in locus parentis meant that we were sort of being, that reinforced mm-hmm. that to some extent. So I do remember lots of discussions about things like that. And as more women came, we did have, women did meet with each mm-hmm. other. We had, and I would say this would have been in the 70s and 80s, probably, early 80s. Really up until when we had enough women, mm-hmm. and I would say that would be in the late 80s, we began a real push mm. to have more women in tenure track positions and mm. so forth. So that in this earlier period, women were wanting to share what it felt to be like at Bowdoin. And there were a couple different kinds of meetings we would have. Sometimes we would have a meeting before votes in the faculty meeting mm-hmm. To sort of talk about what we thought we might do in terms of voting. We had at least one potluck every semester, which was just a social event. And we also had, and that might have gone for 15 years, I would say, what I'm talking about now. And then also we had meetings, maybe bimonthly, or where someone would talk about their research. And it didn't matter whether it was women-oriented or not. It was just there were, you know, there were maybe five women, then there were six women, and so forth. So I do remember those as being a very supportive and interesting way of having this connection to other women. As women and the politics at the college became, and women hit some sort of critical mass, I'm not sure exactly, but I would say that it would have been in the late 80s, perhaps there was a much greater political alliance to the department and the discipline in terms of politics. And I think that was probably a normal and sign of progress, that a critical mass had been reached so that women were more part of, in a kind of expected way within their discipline and their division and whatnot.
And so to sort of shift back to some of the course offerings you were mentioning, I'm curious, when you came to the college, sort of how much of the courses you were going to offer in the German department were either designed by you and then you presented to a committee, or if you sort of were able to or take on a tablet that was sort of given to you, and if and how the course offerings you've given over the years sort of have shifted. Or if they have it all.
Yeah. No, that's a good question. Well, a lot of this has to do with the size of the department. And the larger departments, I would suggest, have a greater specialization because they can afford to have larger numbers who, and then those faculty members focus and teach their specialty and maybe a couple introductory courses or In German, we all taught language, and this was generally true of all the language departments. Everybody's teaching language at the beginning, and then we taught some period courses in German culture and literature. But what we taught within that period in culture was up to us, so we did that. And as time went on, I began to, of course, to, within those period courses, focus on the research on women, incorporate that to some extent. You know, reading Faust, not always identifying with Faust, but asking both the men and women in the class to be Gretchen and look at the, you know, the context, the historical context out of which some of these stories arose. So that I think people did do that in the humanities. And as I said, at some point, I would have to go back and look exactly when this happened. I did teach, co-teach a course on literature and women, and this was the representation of women as well as the, you know, the cultural status of women and sociological status of women as a context for literature. So I'm trying to think who I taught that with. I think I taught that with there was a dean of students called, her name was Alice Early, and she, and I believe, I'd have to look it up, maybe Barbara Castor,
okay.
The three of us taught various aspects of that. Or maybe it was someone in economics who is no longer, didn't stay with the college, who we had people come in and, you know, it was kind of a, it feels very loose and hodgepodge when one thinks of how courses are put together in women's studies today. And then the course on history of German literature with a focus on women. I usually had between 20 and 30 people in there in English. And I remember having Cynthia McFadden, who is on, is it ABC? Was in my class on history of German, and I still remember that very, and she was a wonderful student, of course. And that was very satisfying, these early attempts to have a presence. But the whole story of the evolution of women's studies was very long and difficult. There were lots of obstacles along the way that really were mostly a kind of lethargy, and of course the few women who were at Bowdoin wanted to be of course successful in their careers, not as women but as scholars, and so there were a lot of conflicts for each person, and but it's very obvious that we made terrific progress and have quite an excellent women's studies, gender and women's studies. That the term gender came later, and
so you know, this is might be a rather large question. If you sort of think about your professorship, if you will, at the college. And starting in the early years during that transition, is there any sort of thing that stands out to you that's shifted, whether it's been in the faculty relations, your relations with students, etc., for you in that time period that seems very different from when you initially started?
Wow, that's a good question. I've often thought of this, and people have asked me such questions, but they often ask about how students changed, and you know, I tend to attempt to describe sort of pre-Reagan, post-68 versus a sort of turn away from politics in this you know, what I would call a kind of total commitment, where students were just involved in these things, and you know, coming off the Vietnam War and this kind of experience at the college. So obviously, students have changed in some of the ways they embrace the world. And of course, since technology, they have so many more resources, and it's really an exciting pedagogical environment, and there's just so much efficiency if one chooses to go that way. And so while there have been all these kinds of changes, I, of course, have also changed a great deal. And so once that critical mass came, I no longer taught the specific women's courses in English, but focused, I mainstreamed that in my courses. And I did many honors projects with women's studies focus, and worked in that regard very much with the women's studies program after it became more established, and we had a minor in the late 80s was when that happened, right? And so so I did change my focus. And so, and I've gotten a lot older. And so one's relationship with students is also an evolution, because you learn a lot from them, you learn a lot from the experience, you learn what makes sense in terms of a focus in contemporary classes, for example. When I first came to Bowdoin, you know, students would go away for a year. They usually flew. When I studied in Germany, I went on a boat. You see what an old lady you're talking to. When I was in Germany, there was, you know, no email. I had one phone call in 1 year when I was away. And so much has changed. And one of the things that became apparent is in, for example, a contemporary post-1945 class, which when I began teaching it, it was 30 years. And then suddenly it becomes this huge period, longer than any other period. and it's very important to keep a post-1945 class also a class in contemporary Germany. And so I did look at and have taught usually the difference between the German feminist movement and the American women's movement in that class. And in, of course, in these honors projects where it really plays a role. And so from my own experience, it's really been this simultaneous evolution of the feminist movement, the changing culture and modes of learning in our own, just in our own society, and then my own aging. But a constant throughout all that is, you know, the wonderful energy that students bring to learning. And, you know, the 4 years, this is such a special time. You know, people, some people go to great high schools, some people go to lousy high schools. And, you know, the people who haven't been prepared as well, it takes them a little bit longer, but then they're just, it's in a blooming of experience and really acquisition of knowledge and analytical skills, critical thought, all of that is, it's so exciting to be part of that and to watch that unfold. And I must say that I don't see that having changed very much. There are all these other things that are going on and just pestering us to death, you know. And, you know, different fads and different ways of being young and a different, you know, and much of that is positive, certainly. But that burst of competence and intellectual abilities is really, I think, what we're after, and that really hasn't changed that much.
And would you say in this time, whether it's due to just time passing or the college changing, how the department dynamics changed at all? Did you feel as if it was sort of this constant, as you mentioned before, welcoming, gracious, or were there slight shifts in with people going and people coming?
Well, because we're such a small department, that's really hard to gauge because I worked with the same two people for a long time. Mm. But institutionally, certainly, you know, there were hard-fought battles to get maternity leave, for example, or, you know, when we first began, everybody was trying as women to sort of succeed sociologically. I mean, in order to succeed, there was a kind of shift to being more masculine. Mm. In, you know, there were just certain things you couldn't really manage very well. And some people did it even early on. Certainly, the wealthier you were, you could handle it better. But as time has gone on, you find many wonderful, much more gender equality in who's taking care of the children, who's doing this, who's doing that, you know, raising children and having a family life outside of a career. And, you know, that has shifted. Mm. And some of that has been institutionally supported as things have gone along, and there's been more and more women and more women actually pushing for it. And that's really what it takes, is to have a critical mass so that the voices can be heard. Mm-hmm. And so in that regard, now I would say that there are a lot of people who don't think things are perfect now. But, you know, from my own experience, now I'm retired. You know, it seems great. Certainly there are still a lot of issues with, you know, alcohol, substance abuse, date rape, sexual abuse, harassment, and all that, which is at least acknowledged and spoken of and, you know, people are aware of. The sort of heteronormative environment has changed a lot. This has allowed much greater freedom for students to be themselves and find a place within the community that it doesn't feel hypocritical or, you know, the really negative effects of closetedness that was certainly part of the early Bowdoin. And so looking at it from my longer perspective, you know, I see Bowdoin as a wonderful place to get a good education. And with lots of experience, lots of possibilities. There, at my, you know, at times I think that a lot gets taken for granted because, you know, it's there and it should be part, and it should be taken for granted to some extent. The question is whether one has some little bit of responsibility to seize those opportunities that were created by people who, you know, slogged through the trenches earlier on. And so sometimes I think, well, you know, within my 99% positive outlook on all of this, I think that you know, although it's clear that each generation of women must find their own way to be independent and experience fullness of life and fulfillment, their own personal, fulfill their own personal aspirations. There are times when I think there's so much, you know, it's a little bit lackadaisically taken for granted. But that's 1% of the generally positive.
Well, you have been so wonderfully informative, and I just want to give you an opportunity, if there's any kind of topic or something you'd like to address, feel free to. Otherwise,
wow. I think I probably got most of it out.
Fantastic.